The first one, how can the church assist parents in bringing up their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, particularly education, K-12, that type of education? How can the church assist parents that way?
The church can assist parents who are, if parents have accepted this responsibility and they know that it is their responsibility, I can think of two major ways the church can be a support to them. Number one, they could be a support to them from the pulpit in the teaching ministry of the church. So not only teaching them the obligation, I mentioned that initially, the obligation, but in addition to teaching the biblical requirement of a godly Christian education, I would say you need periodically to have sermons that are directly aimed at encouraging parents who are in the trenches, right? So if you've got a church full of homeschooling moms, you need to have the pastor saying periodically from the pulpit, I know how hard you're working. I know how tough it is. I know that sometimes you can't see the end of it and you don't know why you're doing it. How did I get into this? But I want you to know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. It's that kind of open acknowledged encouragement that should be more frequent than Mother's Day, appreciations. It should be sort of part of the asides in the sermon or particular exhortations. That kind of encouragement. Don't underestimate the power of well done. Don't underestimate the power of, we know you're doing it. We know, we appreciate it very much. So that's one thing. Another thing is we have at Christ Church, we don't want any covenant child in the church to miss a Christian education because of money. Right? So tuition at Christian schools can be expensive and can be expensive for a strapped family. And oftentimes the Christian school that is charging that tuition is itself strapped. There are financial challenges all around. We have, as a subset of our deacons fund, we have a Christian education fund, and that is ministry of the church where we help Christian parents with either tuition at Logos or tuition at the other Christian academies, or helping them with homeschooling materials. We provide tangible financial assistance to Christian parents who might be tempted to not provide a Christian education because of money. So our standard is we don't want any covenant child in the church to not get a Christian education because the parents were strapped.
Doug, in the first Q&A, you mentioned the young mother at your church who
Yes.
has a court order
Right.
that her kids will be in public school. So I guess what you're talking about in your talk is possible under those kind of circumstances, and
Yes.
you can encourage her to do that. How would you address the should question?
With her?
Well, with more generally, with can Christian parents do what the sorts of things you've been talking about today with their children in public school? Or should they rethink that? Should they reconsider that?
I think the average Christian parent with their kids in public school should rethink it. And here's the reason. If you get your concordance out or your Bible search software out, you won't find any sin called sending your kids to public school. There's no sin like that. But you do have the requirement to bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, which is not what they're doing at the public school. That's not what's happening. And so I believe that it's possible for... I went through public education from kindergarten through my master's degree, and whenever there was a conflict, whenever there was a known conflict between what the school was teaching me and what my parents taught me, I always went with my parents. The loyalties were intact, but there were a host of areas where there were conflicts that I didn't know were conflicts. Right? I wasn't educated enough to know that there was a conflict here. I didn't know that there was a choice to make. And a child's not in a position to know what's being done to him. But For example, there's some Christians are just superstitious about this, and if let's say a homeschooling family put their senior son into the government school the last year of his education so they could play football, right? And everybody freaks out. And the parents said, no, I think he's going to do a lot more damage to the government school than they're going to do to him. He's apologetically trained. He loves Jesus. He's going to do this, and he gets to play football, and he can witness to the... If he really does that, I don't have any objection, because he can do that because he has received a Christian education. The second grader is not in a position to do that because the second grader has not yet received a Christian training. If you say, I want to send my second grader to the government schools so they can be salt and light, I'd say, well, why don't you send them to Nairobi? They need salt and light there. You can't go to Nairobi. You need to be trained. Ah, training, I said. Training good? Christian training? Yes, Christian training. Ah, Christian education. There's nothing automatically sanctifying about going from 12th grade to 13th grade. All the people who would freak out at putting your kids in 12th grade, it's standard operating procedure for many of them to send their kids to 13th grade, freshman year at Behemoth U, which is far worse than the local high school frequently. So the issue is, are your kids equipped? That's the issue. Are your kids equipped to do battle? Are they equipped to identify what's going to be thrown at them? And are they equipped to hold their own and come back at them? And if they are, I don't have any automatic complaint. Does that make sense?
Okay. Can you address some of the common pitfalls of both homeschooling as well as private Christian schooling, and how we should deal with those?
Okay. Here's one common pitfall. There are. I'll just give two categories. And if you're a homeschooling family, watch your sons. If you're a Christian school family, watch your daughters. So oftentimes, if you're homeschooling, boys, at past a certain point, boys are no longer in their natural environment. They're no longer functioning in the environment where God intended for them to function, and they start to know it, and they start to resent it, and chafe at it, and they misbehave in order to sort of get out of there, or to show their independence, or they capitulate. So oftentimes, more often than not, temptations and challenges will happen with boys who are homeschooled rather than girls who are homeschooled. In Christian schools, oftentimes because girls want to please their instructor and they have a natural tendency to be institution friendly, oftentimes girls can have their allegiance to their family distracted by or taken away from family by the school that they're in, or by their circle of friends, that sort of thing. So this is not to say that you can't do a godly job in either setting, but it's that if you have boys there, make sure that they get out, make sure that they get into opportunities where they can get knocked down, make sure that they get into the rough and tumble, that it's not going to be in the kitchen at home with mom and their sisters. Watch your boys. With your girls, make sure that you stay engaged with them. Dad, take particular care to be an active, protective shield for your daughter from the cattiness of friends, from the tyranny of cliques, from the pep rally temptations, where you think everything's fine, everything's good, because she really loves school. Yeah, but it might not be healthy. All our daughters went through Logos School. I think it can be done. I think it can be done both ways. I've seen it done both ways in a righteous and godly way. But that's the basic breakout temptation. The second thing is, and this is just pedagogically, the homeschooling has to fight against the fact that division of labor is missing. So at a Christian school, you can have a math teacher who's all about math and has given his life to the study of math and loves teaching math. In a homeschooling setting, you've got a beleaguered mom who's got a second grader, a fourth grader, and a sixth grader. It wasn't that tough when she was teaching her oldest to read. But now, this year, she's teaching every subject, preparing every subject. And then next year, and she can't be an experienced teacher because next year she's got, everybody shifts one grade, and now it's math, history, science, language in three different grades. So after a while, once the kids learn to read, it becomes an easy temptation to just let them pick their own books and read their way up through high school. So I've seen standardized test scores, for example, they're broken out in verbal and math from homeschoolers, and the verbal looks like it was, you know, a test taken by John Donne or somebody, you know, a master of the language, and the math portion looked like it was taken by a rock that was having trouble holding the pencil, you know. It was totally lopsided. And if Nancy and I had homeschooled, and both of us are college educated, both of us are teachers, both of us are educated in the humanities, and I think we could have given an outstanding homeschool education, K through 12, in about three of the subjects, and a woefully deficient education in the other. So I would tell homeschool parents, make sure you're taking advantage of co-ops, of online instruction, of some of the textbooks, some of the materials that have come out. That'd be the second. Right.
Get some more. Okay. This next one when is it age appropriate to introduce children to Plato? I have personal
Plato
experience.
Plato or Plato?
Yeah. The first one when they stop eating it. but more along the lines of classical stuff. You know, you mentioned Nate learning Herodotus or learning that stuff. At what age are they able to, you know, really able to give that to them?
As an advocate of classical Christian education, I would point to the Trivium, the model of the Trivium, which gives us direction. If we apply the Sayers insight to the Trivium, we took it and test drove it, and we have found that this works marvelously well. So if the Trivium is grammar, dialectic, or logic, and rhetoric. Grammar, it would be the various facts that you have, multiplication tables, spelling, geography, names, dates, history, geography being names and rivers and mountains and crops and stuff, history being names and dates and that sort of thing, where the kids just rote memorization. Then if you move from what Sayers called the Paul Parrott stage into the Pert stage, the kids start saying, usually around sixth or seventh grade, why do we have to learn this? Right? The kids become argumentative. They start to dispute. What are you making me do this for? And Sayers' argument is when the kids manifest this, always cut with the grain. So when they start arguing with you, teach them how to argue. Right? And that's where we introduce formal logic. That's where it's the analytic stage. Take things apart, put them back together. You teach them to diagram sentences. So they accumulate a pile of facts in the grammar stage. They start sorting them out and relating them to one another in the dialectic or logic stage. And that would be roughly the junior high years. And then the high school years would be the rhetoric stage, where they learn to polish and present. So at Logos, that's where we have the literature courses, Brit Lit, American Lit, Classical Lit, all happen there. Apologetics happens there. Sort of choral presentations, high-level, musical, rhetorical presentation is what it's all about. And the students by that time have a capacity for abstract thought. So I would say if you're going to study Greek philosophy, Plato, and you should not be just taking it across. You should be critiquing it, analyzing it. That should be the high school years, 10th, 11th grade. If you are talking about stories, Herodotus, that could be more appropriate. You know, some of the kids would eat it up a little bit earlier, although some of the subject matter might be a little bit dicey in Herodotus, not age appropriate that way. You might.
Okay, you maybe address this a little bit, but at least in our church, we have a lot of families that live, pretty far away in rural areas where it would be difficult, even if there was a really good one, for them to go to a private Christian school.
Right.
So, is homeschooling the only option, or what other options?
There are many circumstances where homeschooling is the only godly option. So, and even though my wife and I picked a very good classical Christian school, I can imagine moving to any number of communities where I would pick homeschooling over the local school available. Right? So it's not, I'm not saying I'm going to drive a Chevy no matter what. I'm going to say, well, I'm going to drive what I think is going to get me there. Right? So if you're in a position where there's no Christian school available, or there's no good Christian school available, or there is, and there's no likelihood of you ever being able to build one because you live in a community with 17 people and you're the only Christians, it's homeschooling or nothing. And if you're a farmer and this is land you can't really leave, this is your livelihood and so forth, then what you have to do is work where you are, and homeschooling is going to be your only option. Fortunately, especially as you get to the division of labor problems I was talking about earlier, where that really becomes acute is going to be junior high and high school years. Fortunately, there are many online options that are cropping up and being that are available now. Logos School has, we just had our first graduation from Logos Online Academy. So we've got a four-year high school program that serves both homeschoolers, and we also pipe in an instructor for small, if you have a small school or a small co-op, where you've got everything but a Latin teacher, or you have everything but a math teacher, we supply teaching that's live stream teaching into the classroom, where we can supply a distance teacher for small struggling schools. There are many options for homeschoolers that just simply did not exist 30 years ago. So I would just say, stay where you are, be faithful, do it there. Get reinforcements. There are plenty of them.
Okay, this one is more about children that are not yet school age, but I think it's really good. What do you think is the value of memorized catechisms for young kids, and what age did you start to begin doing that?
I think there's great value in memorized catechisms, but link it to everything I've been saying about delight. You want the kids to be able to repeat their catechism answers, but you don't want it to be bowl or gravel catechism. If you ask them what is the chief end of man, you want them to be exuberant about the fact that it's to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. If you ask them what is their only hope in life and in death, you want them to be exuberant about the answer. You want them to love you asking, and you want them to love answering. And it's all in how you do it. If it's just a beat down, here's your questions, answer them, get them right, then they're going to know it, but they're not going to love it. So you want them to know it and love it. So when our kids were little, I didn't have them memorize the catechism, but we used the Westminster oftentimes as a discussion point for dinner table discussion. It was sort of guided discussion. Here's the question, here's the answer, let's talk about this as sort of setting the theme of the dinner. How young do you start? Well, we have every Saturday night, we kick off the Lord's Day. We observe the Lord's Day from 6 o'clock Saturday to 6 o'clock Sunday. So our Sabbath observance is inaugurated at 6 o'clock Saturday night. And our kids come over with all the grandkids. So I was telling somebody in the break that we are a peculiar form of empty nesters. There's either two of us or there's 24 of us. And it's 24 when there's no company, and there's frequently company. And then and we have NSA boarders, girls boarding with have Sabbath dinner. That's 28. And my dad, anyway, there's a lot of people. And My wife is amazing because she's putting on the equivalent of a Thanksgiving dinner for 30 people every week. So it's just part of the culture. We want to serve the best wine, we want the best desserts, we want the best food. Why? Because it's the Lord's Day. Oh boy, it's the Lord's Day. Not, oh, here's the day I've got to sit and stare at the wallpaper. So we have this celebratory time. And we begin by saying, raising a toast, the best wine, this is the day the Lord has made. Everybody responds with, we will rejoice and be glad in it. And everybody has a glass of wine, down to the youngest grandchild, who is Shadrach, who is 2 now. But he's got a little cup of wine like this in front of him. Absolutely everybody toasts. This is the day the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. And I welcome any company that we have. Then I pray, and we give the day to the Lord. And then I say, a blessing for my wife. May her house always have 7, and all the kids yell pillars. And may she always mix her wine with wisdom. And then a blessing for the children. Happy are the people whose God is the Lord. And then I stop, and they finish it for me. And then we have catechism question. Well, we have a brief exhortation where a paragraph where I say, kids, this is why you should be laugh with your cousins, and this is why you should do this sort of thing. And then there's catechism questions. And Shadrach gets the first question, and it's, Shadrach, who made you? And for a good year or so, he'll sit there. Everybody, and then he'll say, God, and everybody cheers. Yay, Shadrach. And then you work your way through, and the oldest kid in each family asks the catechism questions for his younger siblings. And then they get through to the end. And if any family's absent or if a kid's absent, all the kids know all the answers to all the catechism questions. Anybody can, okay, kids, the Merkels aren't here. You be the Merkels. And everybody can answer all the... And then the last catechism question is, kids, what's the point of the whole Bible? And everybody yells, kill the dragon, get the girl. So that's the point of the whole Bible. And then we sing Psalm 134. And this is something that all the kids look forward to. One time Nancy was talking to one of the kids and said, we want to do this, we love doing this, but we don't want anybody to feel trapped. Open hand, if you want to start doing your own thing, we're not trying to get rid of you, we love this, but... And one of the kids, I forget which kid it was, Mom, are you crazy? This really is foundational. And it's catechesis. And if someone ever said, I'm sure that any of these kids, when they're 45, if someone said, what's the point of the whole Bible? I know what's going to pop into their head.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.